World Soccer Talk podcast. My name is Christopher Harris, and we're joined by Kartik Krishnayar. This week we're doing this on video and, of course, on audio podcast. So if you do want to watch this on video, head on over or subscribe to youtube.com/worldsoccertalk. Kartik, how was your weekend?
It was quite good, and a lot going on in the world of football. Tough to keep up with everything.
I know this is something that really bothers you, as it does me, for different reasons. But VAR is having an impact, I think, on you've said this before, but it's having an impact on the enjoyment of the game. Not only the enjoyment of the game, but particularly the Premier League. To me, it's just getting involved too many times, and then it's taking too long to make a decision. It disrupts the flow of the game, and it's so frustrating to watch. I mean, just a couple of examples, obviously, from this weekend. One was the Man United against Fulham game, the goal that was disallowed due to Harry Maguire, a subjective offside decision, which was near the back post and interfering with the defender. If we had to go back through the last, say, 20 to 30 years and analyze some of the greatest goals scored in the history of soccer, if we took VAR, probably about half of those would be disallowed because of some small thing that happened. Oh God, Kartik, what's your take on this whole VAR controversy?
I hate VAR. I don't think it should be there. I think what it's done is added an extra layer of subjectivity to the process. Maybe it's shielding referees from criticism because now you have VAR officials that get criticized, but it's slowing down the game. It's curtailing the enjoyment. In fact, after a goal now in the Premier League specifically, you wait and you don't react until it's been confirmed. Now, I have to say this season I'm watching, I always watch a lot of Bundesliga, but I'm watching more of Italy, more of Spain than I have the last few years. VAR gets as many decisions wrong in those leagues, and particularly in Germany last season. I got several decisions wrong, in my opinion, but as many bad decisions in those leagues as in the Premier League. But there's a key difference. Those decisions are made quickly in those leagues. The Premier League seems to have a specific problem with drawing the decision-making out, which Stuart Robson, who, by the way, was on COCOMs for the Derek Klassiker, which hopefully we don't talk about that match again after this, but was on COCOMs with Derek Ray this weekend on ESPN Plus for Derek Klassiker, has made the point more than once that he thinks the Premier League has deliberately made VAR a spectacle, because the Premier League is largely about entertainment and spectacle. So he's actually made the point previously on ESPN FC that that's why its application looks different in the Premier League than it does in the other leagues in Europe. But it's getting as many calls off in every league, and honestly, it's just added another level of subjectivity. And here's my last point. People tend to, and fans, I get it, they obsess about the one bad call that went against their club and the manager complaining after the match, which, by the way, happens all the time in the Championship in League One and League Two, where there is no VAR. But the reality of the situation, in my opinion, has been through the years, and I used to get as worked up about officiating 15 years ago as people do now. I realize over the course of a 38 match season, this is the wonderful thing about European football being season structured and not having playoffs and all these things like American sports, because yes, in American sports with playoffs, one random call can cost you, right? Random bad call or wrong call. These things even out over a 38 match season in the Premier League. They even out over a 46 match season in the Football League. They even out over a 34 match season in the Bundesliga. I'm convinced of that. And there was no need for VAR in the first place, because yes, a bad call can cost the team in one match, but then the next match they get a fortuitous call, and the manager and the fans don't complain about that. But these things always tended to even out over the course of a season.
Right. So two things. Like, one thing about Stuart Robson mentioning that this is a spectacle, that the Premier League wants the VAR to be a spectacle. Well, to me, it's having the kind of the reverse reaction, which is a bad spectacle, embarrassing, just so frustrating to watch. But the thing about it evening out over the course of the season, I know this has been a point of yours, Kartik, for many, many years. But what about like Sheffield United, right? Sheffield United many years ago got relegated because of, I mean, if you look at the number of points that they got relegated by, there was a goal that they scored, but it wasn't picked up. This is before VAR, right? And it should have been scored.
And there was a dive by Steven Gerrard in another match that gave Liverpool a penalty, which Liverpool won 1-0 against Sheffield United. Yes. In fact, when I made the point, Chris, that was the one example that stuck out in my mind as being contrary to that. 2006-2007 Sheffield United under Neil Warnock, they did get screwed in two matches. Now, I could go back through their matches and maybe find some contrary evidence, but that it's funny you mentioned that because that was the one example when I made the point 2 minutes ago that I thought, that's the one piece of contradictory evidence. So, that was a bad thing for Sheffield United. And then, of course, there was the Carlos Tevez controversy that year, too. Maybe they shouldn't have been relegated at all because right. West Ham should have been docked points. But that's one example. But I think there are countless other examples of calls evening out over the course of a season. And in that case, Sheffield United still had a final match day against Wigan with a winner take all, winner stays up. Actually, Sheffield United only needed a point. Wigan needed all 3 points, and Wigan beat them. So they still had an opportunity to stay up in spite of that.
Does it feel like to you that the Premier League has more, like, so more VAR decisions being made? I mean, so many instances where the offside decision goes down to kind of basically centimeters, where there's so many kind of close calls, whether it's handballs. Is it just that we're watching more of the Premier League, or is it just that these incidents seem to happen more often?
No, I think these incidents happen more often. The Bundesliga, there are very few reviews. Now, again, like I said earlier, many of those reviews they've gotten wrong. And I think they blew a couple of calls late last season, which were critical in the title race. So that's worthy of discussion that every league is having these problems. But I think the Premier League, they interject more. There's some sort of protocol about interjecting. And the thing that's really surprising to me is Howard Webb is now managing the officials in England. When he implemented VAR in the United States, I attended a workshop with him. It was a 3-hour workshop before VAR was implemented. And as they were implementing it initially in USL in order to make it work in MLS. And I spent some time with him, and he was very much concerned about the intrusiveness of it and making sure it didn't really interrupt the flow of play. And as we've seen in MLS, it was implemented differently. And I think, I still wish they didn't have it, but implemented in a more correct fashion or in a less intrusive fashion than in the Premier League. Now, maybe it's just that Webb has inherited what Mike Riley implemented in the PJMOL implemented in England, and it's a hot mess.
Yeah, so the intrusiveness of it is key because, like, to me, the Premier League, it's almost like they do all of their dirty laundry in front of the public, which is going through the VAR, and you see the frames, you see the same frames that the VAR officials see, where they're rewinding a frame and then fast-forwarding and back and forth and looking at a different angle. You're seeing that as they're seeing it. And watching Major League Soccer again this weekend in terms of some of those playoff games, there are incidents where something happens where I'm watching a game and Sporting Kansas City against St. Louis, and I'm like, oh my gosh, okay, that definitely should be a red card for sure. The player's hurt, he's down. That was a really, really, really physical tackle from behind. And then they mention, okay, yes, obviously VAR is going to take a look at this. And then maybe about 30 seconds to a minute later, the referee blows his whistle and the game continues. So for the viewer, it feels like, okay, it's less disruptions. It's less intrusive. We're actually, and the game continues, right? But to me, though, we miss that dirty laundry. Shouldn't that have been a red card? There's a lot of trust and faith placed in the MLS VAR that they're getting it right. And a lot of people think that the MLS method is better. I'm not so sure they're getting the decisions correct. And maybe the Premier League one is like they're so focused on making the right decisions and scared of making a wrong decision in case they get sued or demoted. Or so it's like, I think of it as the Wizard of Oz, when they go to the Emerald City and there's the wizard and all these wonderful things are happening. Well, Major League Soccer, basically the wizard's behind the curtain. He's like pulling on the levers. He's doing all everything behind the scenes. So you don't get to see kind of what's actually happening. With the Premier League, it feels that that curtain has been lowered and you see the kind of people behind the scenes, or you see the frames. And it's so frustrating because it does take too long.
Yeah, and in terms of that Sheffield United example you brought up, this season Luton, I think, were probably lost a point because of VAR not acting against West Ham. And so that point might loom large for Luton at the end of the season. Similarly, maybe Sheffield United wouldn't have gotten the VAR decisions, as it turns out. Against Liverpool, in the one I'm thinking specifically, you're right about the handball. I'm remembering when Gerrard clearly died for a penalty, and converted the penalty, and Liverpool beat them 1-0 late that season. I think this is an interesting point, because Howard Webb, in the workshop we had with him, which now was six and a half years ago, MLS implemented VAR in 2017. They started it as a pilot program in select USL matches, which is what he was walking us through that day. And then they implemented it full on in MLS for the playoffs that year in 2017. So it's been 6 years, seven seasons, really. And he was stressing to us, the VAR officials are always working. So the game may continue, the match may continue, but they're making a decision. They're reviewing the tape. They're in communication with the referee on the field. And they'll make the decision quickly, which is exactly what you're alluding to in MLS. Now, in terms of the Premier League, it seems like they always blow the whistle when there's a VAR review and they walk us through everything. Maybe they think that's more transparent. So you're right. Actually, as you mentioned it, you make a great point, Chris. We don't know about there is no transparency in the MLS system, right?
Right.
We're just trusting them that they got the decision right, or that they reviewed the decision at all. In the Premier League, we're seeing everything, but it's slowing down matches. Like this Newcastle-Arsenal situation the other day, I don't know whether it should have been a goal or not, right? That's debatable, and obviously that's very controversial, whether Anthony Gordon's goal should have stood. But here's the reality. They did three different VAR reviews on one goal. On one play, piece of play.
Yeah.
And that doesn't happen in Germany, Italy, Spain, France, MLS, anywhere else in the world. So I think it is a real problem in the Premier League.
Yeah, my feeling, I mean, so I don't think things even out over the course of a season. They're probably, some seasons it might be that way, but some seasons I think teams get definitely hurt by some of these decisions. I'm against VAR. I think they should either eliminate it completely, which a lot of people say, well, they can't do that now, it's too late. But anyway, to me, there's still a possibility, but get rid of it completely or change the laws of the game. Change the laws of the game. I mean, when you think about it too, I mean, the handball decision in terms of soccer was originally brought in to stop people kind of a deliberate handballs. I mean, basically almost they can't play like rugby. Yeah, there's no hands involved. So when it's accidental, it's accidental to me. If it's a blatant handball, it's a handball. Even the push on the back for that goal by Newcastle, to me, I don't know. It's if you're going to go down to that, I don't know. To me, it's like it's a physical game. You mean allow those types of things unless it's a blatant foul. And to me, having watched that so many times, I mean, depending which side of the fence you're on, you might see it one way or the other. But to me, if it's not completely blatant, then the goal should stand, which it did.
They don't even get the handball decisions right. I mentioned the Luton situation against West Ham earlier in the season when Ward-Prowse clearly has his hand in an unnatural position.
Yeah.
The ball strikes his hand in the area. It should be a Luton penalty, and I think that was like the fifth minute of stoppage time. So assuming Carlton Morris or whoever steps up and takes it and converts it, that's one point. Because it was so late in the match. we can definitively say it would have made a difference. So they're not even getting the handball interpretations right, because there are other times VAR is looking at handballs, which are clearly ball to hand, hand tucked in, and they're calling it.
Yeah.
It depends on who the VAR official is. And so, and it's, these, again, it's subjective.
And these are the biggest talking points of the weekend. You know what I mean? Right, I mean, right. You and I are starting off the podcast talking about a VAR. That's probably the last thing we want to talk about.
So yesterday, Sky, for their Sunday football, they spent the first 17 minutes of their program on the controversy in the Newcastle Arsenal match.
Right.
Before they got to talking about Luton and Liverpool and whatever the Nottingham Forest and Villa.
Similar to NBC, NBC started off their broadcast on Sunday morning talking about VAR and Newcastle United against Arsenal, getting the opinions of Tim Howard and Robbie Muster, whether they think should they keep it or not. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I was going to say same thing with NBC then. It was 17 minutes on Sky. It was similar on NBC. I assume I didn't watch the NBC studio show. But this is, as you said, Chris, you're spot on. This is what we talk about coming out of the weekend. I'm sure when I listen to Football Weekly later today from The Guardian, it'll be the same thing. They'll start with this, and it'll be all about VAR and Arteta raging. And Arteta will rage whenever they lose, right, and whenever there's some controversy. So I don't put much stock into that, although it'll be interesting to see how the Premier League comes down on him. But it took three different replays of the same action. And I think, again, I don't know if the goal should have stood or not. I think on the surface it probably should have. That's my opinion. But if not having VAR means it didn't stand and it was nil-nil and we didn't have 7 minutes of delay or whatever it was, I'm fine with that. That's better for me. Nil-nil, they split the points when if it takes 7 minutes or however long it took, 5 minutes, 7 minutes to figure it out.
Yeah, it's difficult, right? Because if it's, I mean, people talk about tennis, right? And Wimbledon, and that's, I mean, easier. It's either the ball's in or the ball's out. And they're using all sorts of technology. Same thing with goal line technology. That works. It's either the ball's in or out when it's working. But with offside, though, I mean, what's other than semi-automated offside decisions, using that technology that's been used in Serie A, that's been used in the World Cup, Women's World Cup also, other than semi-automated offside technology, which will help certainly, how can we improve, or how can the authorities improve VAR in the Premier League specifically?
I don't think they can. I mean, offside is objective again, because it depends on the second the ball leaves the foot. And that's very difficult without extensive freeze frames to determine. So there has always been a premise that went before VAR that the advantage goes to the attacking player, because maybe they appear level on the eye, etc. But there was always that feeling, okay, so probably the ball was released. But now we're getting into this where we're drawing lines and we're saying, well, can you legally play the ball with that part of the body, the shoulder slightly offside? It's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous.
I agree. I mean, the tricky thing, so the semi-automated technology is the ball, which is from Adidas, that have the technology that has a chip inside the ball, so they can tell when the ball is kicked, and then measure. So that goal, Newcastle against Arsenal, that final goal where they weren't sure in the last of the three VAR reviews whether or not it was offside or not, and they said, okay, based on what they know, based on what they can see, they weren't able to show whether it was offside. So that kind of stood. With the semi-automated technology, at least with that, they'd be able to see that within a short period of time. Outside of that, I'm with you, Kartik. I don't think there's not much else that they can do.
In other sports, you mentioned this is interesting, because in cricket, I know that they have two types of technology that both are pretty quick, 30 seconds to a minute maximum. Tennis, you mentioned, rugby, we mentioned. Now, I don't watch American football, so I think that it's very long, the delays in American football, but that's, the sport is like that, right? They're 10-minute stoppages in the middle of games. So, but in college basketball, which I watch pretty frequently, I had stopped watching for a few years, but now I'm back full throttle. It's ridiculous. And it's always in the last 2 minutes of games, and the referees are going over to the monitors, and they're taking forever. And this is also having an implication for broadcast, which it will have eventually also in soccer, where college basketball games are no longer on on ESPN or whoever, FS1, NBC, fitting in the broadcast, the proper broadcast windows. Mm-hmm. The previous broadcast windows they would fit into because of replay, as it's called in that sport. And the same thing is about to happen with VAR in soccer. The 90-minute match, the two-hour television broadcast window is going to be a thing of the past, which also means maybe less linear coverage of the sport. I'm concerned about that. It could actually affect, because we already know we have to fight for any coverage we get of this sport in the United States. And so if you're adding a half an hour to potential broadcast windows because of VAR, broadcaster would just say, okay, then it's a streaming property. We don't want to show it on linear. That's a concern of mine.
My final thought about this VAR thing before we move on to the next topic is that for the Premier League, I think they really need to figure this out, because VAR causes two things. One, games are less fun. You're watching a game and it's not as fun as it can be. Well, it has been in the past. And then the second thing is, I forgot. But I mean, the fun part of it too. Imagine if you went to a youth soccer game and they had VAR technology, which they never would. And all of these games would have basically, would be drawn out. A kid scores a goal, and there's even at Fulham against Manchester United, it took 3.5 minutes to figure out whether or not Harry Maguire was, causing interference basically in that play from that Garnacho header.
It's the way the players react. So Chelsea Brentford last weekend at the Bridge. Brentford goes there, beats their West London rival for the third successive match. Did you notice on the second goal, Neil Mopay laid the ball off to, I think it was Wissa or Mbeumo it was, to score. Mm-hmm. Mopay, after Mbeumo puts the ball in the back of the net, what's the first thing Mopay does? Does he run over to Mbeumo? No, he looks at the AR.
Right.
I noticed that clearly. Like, the first thing he did is he looked over, waited for like 5 seconds, and then saw, okay, the flag's not up, I can go celebrate my assist. That's the player reaction. It's awful. So it's taking the joy out of the game, as you said.
Yeah, it's taking the joy out of the game, so it's making the people are less likely to continue watching it and to grow. I don't know. It's really frustrating to watch. All right, Kartik, speaking of something that was not frustrating to watch, I didn't see it, but ESPN2 had a USL League One final this weekend. How was that match? Any VAR controversies? But any other controversies from this game?
Yeah, so North Carolina FC, congratulations to Steve Malik and North Carolina FC. They win on penalties against Mike Jeffries' Charlotte Independence. Great match. Great game for them to show on national television, 120 minutes of good lower division American soccer action. The problem here, Chris, is the entire season of USL League One. Unlike USL Championship, where USL Championship has a lot of games on linear television, USL League One, this is the first match they've had on linear television all year, right? Every other match has been on ESPN Plus. So I didn't realize this when I'm watching the game, right? I just turned the game on. I knew it was on ESPN 2, watched the match. But then I checked my phone after the match. I have about 6 WhatsApp or text messages from people who are fans of lower division soccer who are saying, I didn't get to watch the match because I'm a cord cutter. I've watched the entire season on ESPN Plus. I was promised every USL League One game on ESPN Plus, and they delivered every game until we got to the final. And because it was on ESPN2, they clicked on. Apparently, there was a link that even said in the match tracker, watch every USL League One match on ESPN Plus. You click on it, and then it's asking for your cable or satellite provider. And so a lot of those people didn't watch the match. So this goes to a broader problem, Chris. I think we're in a period where people who have cut the cord expect every match on streaming. And the Bundesliga and La Liga have provided that in the United States. But other leagues haven't. Other leagues are splitting.
And we've seen in just in the last couple of weeks, I mean, La Liga has had some games on ESPN or ESPN2. But at the same time, it's also still on ESPN Plus.
ESPN Plus, right.
The Bundesliga might have done one too in the last couple of months too, where it was on one of the ESPN linear channels. But again, every game on ESPN Plus. So the answer to this one would have been USL and ESPN should have said like, hey, ESPN2, great, but we're also going to have this game on ESPN Plus too.
And I was just going to say that, but I mean,
for Premier League fans too, you mean like we have to go through the whole hoops and hurdles of having, I mean, USA Network and Peacock in order to watch all the games. But this one should have been better communicated, I think, in terms of, you mean that this game was not going to be on ESPN Plus or to resolve it.
Yeah, so I think there was just an assumption it would be on ESPN Plus, because in defense of USL and ESPN, every communication I got from them said ESPN2, which is why I watched the game on ESPN2. And I wasn't aware of this problem until I went through my messages on my phone after the game, actually after the penalty shootout. So 3 hours after, or 2.5 hours after kickoff. But it's a continuing, I think, bugaboo for a lot of people, because they're expecting to get all their soccer via streaming. I understand USL and ESPN's perspective on this. USL doesn't get that many games on linear television, right? So why cannibalize your audience? Why not show, and this is a topic for another day or for my Beyond the 90 site, but Soccer Wars is going on right now between MLS entering the lower division fray and USL. MLS does not have any games of their lower division, MLS Next Pro, on linear television. They're all on Apple. They're all behind the paywall. Right. So I think USL thought, okay, here's a chance for us to show on a Sunday afternoon on ESPN2 a decent number, you know, whatever it'll be, 100,000, 150,000 maybe, and show that we have the momentum in that Soccer Wars. They didn't want the audience cannibalized by streaming, but it made a lot of fans unhappy. But I think the thing that has set the expectation, honestly, Chris, you mentioned La Liga and the Bundesliga. I think that set the expectation, because I've had situations where my ABC station in South Florida doesn't show Bundesliga matches. They preempted it. I've been very angry about it, but I've been able to watch the matches on ESPN Plus. So you kind of expect that as a backup always.
On another newsworthy note, this weekend, there was the FA Cup. I watched a handful of matches. I watched some of the Wrexham against Mansfield, Charlton Athletic against Cray Valley Paper Mills, as well as some other matches. But the first round FA Cup, really enjoyable. And Cray Valley Paper Mills was able to tie Charlton Athletic 1-1 at the Valley, forcing a replay against the former FA Cup holders. But overall, really enjoyable weekend there of FA Cup games. I mentioned MLS before, watched some of the playoff games. Most of them are pretty physical, dull, and boring, except for that Sporting Kansas City against St. Louis game that I mentioned earlier. Then we have Matt Turner getting dropped by Nottingham Forest. And this is interesting too, because Matt Turner, at the beginning of the season, had become the first American goalkeeper to hold a starting position in the Premier League in 7 years. And he was dropped for the new signing, the Greek goalkeeper. But when you think about American goalkeepers in the Premier League, they've been in starting positions. You think of, I mean, Brad Guzan, Brad Friedel, Tim Howard, Casey Keller, Marcus Hanneman.
Jurgen Sommer at one point, or I guess maybe he was in the League One, but what was Division One then, Championship. Ian Foyer played for a while. Was a starting keeper for a while in England in the lower divisions.
It's a long list.
Who?
I was just saying it's a long list. I mean, Tony Meola was at Millwall, I believe.
Yeah, I think. And so was Casey Keller at one point.
Yeah.
And Casey Keller was dropped multiple times in his career. His career wasn't necessarily as smooth as Friedel's in Europe. Got dropped, got replaced at Leicester, got dropped, went to Rayo Vallecano, did fine there, but got dropped at Spurs, but would always battle back. So I want to see how Matt Turner handles this. Obviously, he made some comments earlier in the year, which I disagreed with, right? I mean, about it being harder as an American player. I think it's what about Ecuadorian players? It's not hard for them. It's not hard for Japanese players. It's not hard. I mean, you have to fight. You have to work. You have to be consistent to start at any high-level European club. And this is my kind of overall takeaway about the United States player pool now, which is, I think it's been vastly overrated by a lot of U.S. fans, vastly overrated by a lot of media in this country. You have guys that in specific instances are very, very good, can be spectacular on a given day. The Weston McKinneys, the Christian Pulisics, the Timmy Weahs. But there's a lack of consistency and lack of consistent fitness level among all of these guys. Every single top American player seems to have field player seems to have some sort of fitness issue other than Tim Ream, who in my opinion is the best American player. I think there's a willingness to then make excuses, right? To then say, oh, it's because this manager, I don't know, maybe Steve Cooper prefers Greek people, Greeks to Americans, I don't know. But right. It's the manager, it's the club, it's the media, and it's all such noise at this point. American players have had incredible opportunities in Europe now. Now, 20 years ago, that wasn't the case. 20 years ago, I used to, by the way, people who are now probably angry about what I just said, Chris, you've known me for a long, long time. 20 years ago, I used to complain that Americans weren't getting a fair shot. There was a glass ceiling. There was a perception about American players that was wrong because our guys were fit. Our guys fought. Our guys were hungry. And they were. And guys like Clint Dempsey broke that glass ceiling. Guys like Brian McBride, DeMarcus Beasley, they broke that glass ceiling. So now these guys, this generation of players has incredible opportunities because of those guys. Unfortunately, not always, often they're not taking it. And when it doesn't go their way, they're making excuses. So I want to see how Matt Turner bounces back from this. I'm hopeful that he fights through it and he comes back. I mean, look, our last point, I'll even just say this as a Man City fan. I had people telling me Zach Steffen should start ahead of Ed Ayrson a few years ago. I mean, come on.
Yeah, I think in some ways, I mean, so Matt Turner was dropped because of his form. He's had kind of a shaky few weeks there for Nottingham Forest. And to me, it's democratic, right? It's like in terms of most teams, almost all teams, the coach is making decisions based on how good the players are, and the best players will in those positions will start. So if Matt Turner does go through a shaky period, which he has done, made some mistakes, then there's an opportunity for, the second goalkeeper to come into that position. Now there's an opportunity for Matt Turner to earn that back. It's going to take, a lot of hard work in practice and training. But what it's not going to take is excuses. And we've seen that, you mentioned before too, about Matt Turner making excuses about how it's harder for Americans. Tim Howard's making excuses for Matt Turner several weeks ago, saying Tim Howard was saying that basically he was blaming coaches for being anti-American for the reason why Pulisic was dropped from Chelsea. And it's not based on your nationality, it's based on consistent form. So if you're doing well enough, you'll get your chances. Once you get those chances, you have to keep at that highest level. It's not easy by any means for any player from any country. And you have to stay fit. Yeah. I mean, to me, a lot of it, unfortunately, for the US players, a lot of it's been injuries, right? You look at Tyler Adams. So many injuries, and now he's out until next year at Bournemouth, so on and so forth. But hopefully Tyler Adams will bounce back. And hopefully Matt Turner will try to earn his position back.
Why do Americans? So the one thing that I would argue is that Americans have a disproportionate, they're disproportionate numbers of fitness issues with top American players. So I think we as a soccer playing nation, instead of making excuses, need to figure out why this is. Why are our guys getting injured and being on the mend, on the shelf for longer periods of time than players of other nationalities? Why is this so endemic with American players? The one exception is Tim Ream. I mean, he got hurt earlier this year. It was the first time he'd been hurt in years, and he's in his mid-30s. But he's the last generation, right? So maybe we shouldn't even be talking about him. This generation of American players, there seems to be something really Gio Reyna. I mean, you talked about Pulisic and Weah with injuries. I even forget Gio Reyna as a thing. That's why I didn't mention him, because he's hurt so much.
There's a lot of soccer fans on social media right now asking, why is Gio Reyna not playing all these games? Why is he not starting? And to me, a lot of it, it's not skill. A lot of it is fitness. Is he yet at a match fitness level? Having so many injuries, is he ready to start? I mean, you have to, it takes
and
time
to come back. And it applies to every nationality. You're Welsh, Chris. There's a guy, great Welsh player, Brennan Johnson, right now, who has generally been pretty fit. But since he's gotten to Spurs, he's had injury problems. And I know we're taping this Monday morning. Postecoglou is having to grapple with a decision today. Brennan Johnson is supposedly finally fit. For the first time, really, since he's been at Spurs, since they bought him for $50 million at the end of the transfer window. Does he roll the dice and start him, or is he going to have to sub him off after 30 minutes like he did earlier, the last time he gave him a start? So this applies to players of all nationalities. It's not picking on Americans. It happens to everyone, and unfortunately, we have a disproportionate number of players, particularly Gio Reyna, that can't stay fit at a high level. And look, it isn't like training in the U.S. leagues. You have to be fit and you have to be hungry and you have to be in shape every single day in Europe. Otherwise, you get dropped. And if you're not fit enough, minor injuries will pop up, which is what I think happened with Adams. And then finally, it became a major injury.
So speaking of some American players, a club that had three American players last season, Leeds United, who had Brendan Aaronson, Tyler Adams, and Weston McKennie. Leeds United played on Friday in a game I'm sure you watched too, as well as I, against league leaders Leicester City at Leicester City's ground in the Championship. Really good game. And Leeds United, I think, Kartik, showing some potential, showing some possible opportunities to come back up to the Premier League. Still a long way to go, but what were your thoughts and analysis from this game?
Yeah, and Ipswich lost on Saturday, which helps Leeds. I mean, it's early in the season. I don't really start looking at the table until now. So now I'm looking at the table, and Leeds is now only 6 points out of an automatic promotion spot with that victory and Ipswich losing. We thought it would be 12-point gap after the weekend. So I think they're getting together under Daniel Farke. I think that they have a real opportunity to come back up. And this is we criticize American owners a fair amount, but this is a really good showcase so far for 49ers Enterprises. They've stuck with the project. They bought out Andrea Radrizzani's majority share. They've reinvested in the club. They went out and got a really good manager. I think the right manager for them. It took a month or two with all the ins and outs, but now they're playing really good football, and I think they're going to come back up. I think we're in also, when we've criticized American owners like the Glazers and Stan Kroenke in the past, we're into a second generation of American owners now. And I think you're seeing it with Bill Foley at Bournemouth, even though they're having struggles. But he's really done a good job with that club, I believe, as an owner. Best an owner can do. And 49ers Enterprises, Alan Pace at Burnley, maybe the jury's out because of the way they've started the season. But I think he did a very good job consolidating the club, making some changes, bringing them back into the Premier League. So a couple of good American owners out there, a couple of good American ownership stories.
Yeah, I don't know about that, though, Kartik. I mean, Bournemouth and Burnley, both of them in the bottom three of the Premier League. Yes, I think Foley's been doing a good job in terms of the way he's been running Bournemouth, but I wouldn't be surprised if we see the manager getting sacked during the international break. At Burnley, you mean something's got to change.
Bad. Something has to change.
Company, whatever he's doing, it's not working out at Burnley.
I'm not surprised. I am surprised they're doing so poorly. I'm not surprised Luton has been as competitive as they've been. I said that before the season and got laughed at. They have less points than they should, honestly. But I think Luton under Rob Edwards are going to scrap. They're going to fight. I think ultimately it's 50-50 whether they stay up. Sheffield United have not played as well as I thought they would, but I see more in them than I do in Burnley. So I'm really concerned about Burnley. I do agree with you on that, Chris. I think if I had to pick one team that's nailed to go down at this point, it's them. Yeah. And then if I had to pick a second team, it would probably be Bournemouth. And I'm still not, I think Everton doing great under Sean Dyche, but I still worry that they don't have enough. It's going to come down to the end for them.
Out of the bottom six teams in the Premier League, Kartik, four of them potentially are owned by Americans. So you have Sheffield United, not owned by Americans, but had a win at the weekend. You have Luton Town. So the two exceptions out of those six are Sheffield United, which won, Luton that should have won, almost came so close to winning against Liverpool. The other clubs, Burnley, American-owned, Bournemouth, American-owned, Everton, soon to be American-owned, and then Fulham, American-owned.
And the American owners that are coming into Everton are from my view, terrible owners. And they're based here in South Florida. I've kept track of them. They have done a poor job with their other clubs on the continent, their other investments. So I'm not, Mashiri had to be bought out. Bill Kentright just passed away. Rest in peace to him. So something had to happen at Everton. But I always thought Everton would get a big time owner at some point. It's that kind of club. It's one of the biggest clubs in Europe, in my opinion. And I think they have the wrong ownership. But maybe they'll prove me wrong. Maybe they'll do better in England than they've done on the continent, where they've invested in a number of clubs and not done particularly well.
Yeah, I think the point is the next 6 months are going to be some tough times for some of these American owners of Premier League clubs, some big decisions ahead of them. So let's move on to the listener mailbag. And first up, we have Joe. Joe wants to talk to us about one Premier League commentator in particular, or former Premier League commentator. Joe says, enjoyed the podcast, but couldn't help but notice both of you diss Arlo White again without going into why you don't rate him as a commentator. When I've heard him, he's got a good voice, calls a goal well, and has nice chemistry. There are far worse commentators than Arlo White. Is there something that bugs you both about his professional style? Not to disrespect the man, but you've praised Ian Dark in the past, and I think Arlo White is comfortably better. Kartik, I think, for me personally, Arlo White, I think the ego got too big. He thought that he was one of the reasons why the Premier League was becoming so popular in the United States, which is absolutely laughable. Also was making some decisions behind the scenes to take jobs, such as with Ted Lasso, without getting the approval of NBC Sports. So behind the scenes, even some kind of questionable decisions. In the games itself, personally, I know I felt this way, but was just talking way too much, just was not really a top-level commentator. Yes, he has a great voice. Yes, he calls a goal well. I'd argue about the chemistry he had. I don't think it was quite there, but I felt he was always more of a better TV presenter than a actual television commentator. Anything else to add there, Kartik?
I agree with you and with Joe that he calls a goal really well and he has a great voice. But I think I agree with you. He talked too much. He talked too much about extraneous things. I think there is a certain chattiness to the way Ian Dark. I know Ian Dark is also criticized for talking a lot, but there's a chattiness and an informative nature to the way Ian Dark talks that I don't think Arlo White quite hat. I agree he's a top presenter. I think he's a good studio host. I think he's actually probably pretty good if he's calling the third or fourth biggest match of the weekend. I think he's fine doing that. But when you had him calling all the high-profile matches, that was an issue for me. And you just look at the upgrade. Peter Drury, John Champion, arguably the two best. Yeah. I'm hooked on their commentary. I mean, I've been hooked on Champion for years, right? Various stops he's had prior to this. But Drury, who I knew and obviously would hear call Champions League, there was the epic Roma-Barcelona Champions League tie many years ago that he became famous for, right? That his call on that match. But I'm now hooked on him each and every Saturday, and then you get Champion on Sunday. kudos to NBC. It's not as much about Arlo White being bad as much as it is Arlo White's limitations versus these two guys being just outstanding.
Yeah, it's just a huge upgrade on Arlo White, even in terms of Peter Drury and John Champion, among others. As I predicted, Kartik, I knew we would get some pushback about our constructive criticism about NBC's coverage. Gerald says, I'll take predictable studio hosts with middle-of-the-road views and have all the footy in the world. And I think what Gerald's arguing is that, hey, we should feel fortunate to have access to all these games from around the world. And who cares about the studio coverage? I mean, we have the quantity. Don't worry about the quality of the studio coverage.
Yeah, I agree with that. Where I would disagree with Gerald is the middle of the road views. I think actually one of my criticisms of NBC is that they have extreme views on the top six clubs. So any loss, any hiccup is a major crisis. The way they handle it in the studio. Man United loses one match. Oh my goodness, should Ten Hag be sacked? Man City loses once. Oh, has Pep lost his touch? I mean, I think it's actually extreme, in my opinion. But that's me.
Yeah. Well, this leads into the next question, which is from Greg. Well, actually, it's more of a comment. Greg says, "Oh, good, this discussion again. Serious question. If you admit to not watching the coverage much anymore, how can you say it's better or worse or stagnating?" And Greg, that's a great question, because like from this weekend, what I'm on television, I have NBC Sports on or USA Network or whichever channel is showing the game. So I have it, I'm watching it. And then oftentimes the actual audio or pre-match or halftime or post-match, I'm listening to BBC Radio 5 and other places too, as far as kind of better quality, really expert analysis that I'm not getting with NBC Sports. But your question, Greg, is good, because so I have them both on. Sometimes I'll mute the NBC broadcast to hear what the BBC or TalkSport or ITV or Sky Sports is saying. But sometimes I'll unmute NBC to hear what they're saying or see if there's a really good discussion point or something a little bit different. So that's how I'm able to, I'm not basically watching much of it, but I am still watching bits and pieces of it. And the bits and pieces I'm watching of NBC Sports thus far in the last few weeks especially have been pretty mediocre. And then let's move on. Ryan Evans says, I don't think CBS does good with the leagues that they have now, let alone get the Premier League. And let me just read this next comment too. Jonathan Morrod says, not really in any way that NBC is doing already. NBC must stop using Sky Sports and return to making original content. I know NBC owns Sky, but it's not the same. The first two seasons they had the league was the best soccer coverage the US had for a professional league. CBS will stick the Premier League behind a paywall like NBC did. There is too much opportunity for recurring revenue not to. So the overall experience won't change. As a whole, all the leagues have good homes, except for MLS. Apple TV needs a normal TV partner who is not Fox. Fox's World Cup coverage is the only thing they are getting, they're putting an effort into. Their MLS coverage is basically non-existent. CBS or TNT would be a better partner. So yeah, on the CBS side, and there were several other comments about this too, about how they felt that that CBS is too laffy-laffy, too much of that just kind of nonsense, basically. And from having watched CBS Sports Champions League coverage quite a bit in the last couple of years, really, what I find is that there are segments where they get serious and have really insightful tactical analysis or on screen or interviews or really kind of hardcore. And then the next segment will be kind of a laugh fest. So I think a lot of people are watching, seeing the clips on social media, seeing the laugh fest, but actually not watching kind of the analytical side where they do go deep into that. So, and oftentimes too, right, on a Champions League Tuesday or Wednesday, they might have coverage that starts at, say, at noon and goes through all the way through till about 5 o'clock or 5:30. So there's, a good, I mean, there's games involved in there too, but there's several hours of coverage. So not everyone watches all of it. So I said, so my personal thinking is in terms of CBS and what they do is when they do, kind of go in laser focused on the analysis and those interviews, they're really, really at the top level. And then the nonsense, kind of the laughing, the jokes and stuff like that. Some people love it. Obviously, some people hate it. So, but it's not a, an accurate representation of what CBS would do with the Premier League. Kartik, any additional thoughts about kind of the criticism about NBC Sports and also kind of CBS Sports and kind of the reaction from some of our listeners?
Yeah, I kind of agree on the CBS point. I mean, I do think that there is a little too much laughy, jokey, and maybe at times a lack of knowledge of clubs that are not in England or Spain. I do think that there's like a fall off even with Germany and Italy in terms of their knowledge of their studio team. So. Yeah. That I definitely would criticize. And that's kind of ironic about the Italy portion. The Germany portion bugs me in particular because Bundesliga is my favorite league. But favorite top division league, I should say. But I do think the Italy thing is confounding because they also broadcast Serie A. There's no overlap between Dre Cordero calls games for Champions League, but there's no overlap between the studios, right? So maybe that's something they have to remedy. But no, NBC, I think, has gotten very predictable and very stale. And I do agree with the point about Sky. I think Sky's coverage tends to be very focused on the top brands. And I think this change had happened with NBC before Comcast bought Sky. But yeah, they've really made it Skyified. And I agree. The first two seasons, maybe the first three seasons, because the third season was the Leicester year, right? The first three seasons NBC had the Premier League was the top of the shelf stuff, the best soccer coverage we've gotten in this country ever. And it's kind of dropped off gradually since then. Remember, at the time, they also had Gary Lineker doing some original documentaries or documentaries his Goalhanger Films was doing, but then also would debut on NBC in the U.S. We would have him occasionally in the studio. Steve Bauer was working for NBC at the time. I think that there were Kyle Martino was around then. So I think that they were at a high point, and they were also doing a lot of coverage of the other 14 teams because they were trying to educate Americans about the league. Yep. That has dropped off since year three. So I agree with that comment specifically. I think that's a great point.
Yeah, what I would say about NBC Sports' coverage of the Premier League as a whole is that the top six, when it is a top six team, their analysis is decent. Sometimes great, sometimes not so good, but overall decent. But the teams near the bottom of the division is pretty weak. And we saw that this Sunday too with Nottingham Forest, like pre-match, both Tim Howard and Robbie Musto. Well, Tim Howard was saying that, yeah, I think Nottingham Forest is going to end towards the bottom of the division. Robbie Musto was saying, okay, you mean like, yes, they've had this great home form, but they haven't won a lot of games. And both of them predicted that Aston Villa would win this game pretty convincingly, I think.
They actually won at Stamford Bridge, by the way. So won an away game. Forest, I just know that offhand.
Yeah. And then even Luton Town. I mean, you look at Sunday, right? You look at Nottingham Forest beats Villa. Luton Town almost beats Liverpool. It's really kind of the rise of the underdogs. And they would have predicted too that Liverpool would have won that game against Luton. But their analysis and knowledge more so of those lower league teams is lower division teams is not as good as the top six. Kartik, we've got another comment here. This is from Michael F. Michael says, I'm glad others are echoing what I've thought all along about Paramount Plus's streaming quality of Champions League matches. It's so below par with what is offered by today's video streaming offerings. Earth to Paramount Plus, most households now have large 4K flat screens that easily show the floors of 720p telecasts. It might be worth something, maybe if CBS was head and shoulders above the rest in quality studio and game presentation. But come on, that's not certainly not the case. And others too, kind of chiming in terms of Paramount Plus, kind of saying that they prefer Peacock in terms of the quality of the streaming quality, and that's something too. I know we've talked about before, Kartik, and you've mentioned too, Peacock's streaming quality is some of the best.
Yeah, it's the best, I think, in terms of the actual quality of the streams. There is the clunkiness of Peacock at times, but that's the case with every streaming service. We do, in defense of CBS, have to say that they're showing, six, seven, if it's Europa League and Conference League, like 12 games at once. So that's, and granted, they're picking up the UEFA feeds and just redirecting them and doing whatever cosmetic adaptations to them, but they are showing many more streams at one time than Peacock is at the Premier League. So that's just one little caveat, but in general, I agree with the criticisms. I think Peacock streaming is tip top if you don't have problems with the app. The actual stream is the best. Paramount Plus, it's not. I mean, it is not where we would expect to be in 2023, quite frankly, in a lot of those cases.
And then the two more comments to go. One is from SLC VOL. And this is a message to you, Kartik, regarding taking a break from American politics and soccer. SLC says, turn off the TV. It does wonders about American politics. No need to be a monk across the world.
I completely agree. Totally agree.
And then last but not least, Adam has a comment about HBO Max, now known as Max, and the BR Sports, Bleacher Report Sports. Adam says, I was wondering, with Warner Discovery's new options for their Max service under BR Sports, if they have plans for full game replays or DVR options. As a cord cutter and as a Fubo customer, I was looking at English language options to watch USMNT games normally broadcast on TNT. Sometimes I can't watch games live, and I was looking for options to catch up on games a few hours after they broadcast. Right now, I end up having to watch Spanish language replays on Peacock, which works fine, but I'd really prefer an English broadcast. I've become spoiled with services like Apple Plus, ESPN Plus, Peacock, and Paramount Plus that all offer full event replays. Thank you. Love the podcast. So in answer to that, Adam, and this is something I tested out recently for one of the USMNT games, is they don't have a replay of the games. So all they have is the highlights. So if you go into Max after a USMNT game or a WNT game that airs on TNT and you want to watch that full game later that evening or the next day, it's not available. All they have is highlights. So that's definitely a negative there.
Yeah. I have noticed that also with Max. By the way, I'm not doing a full mea culpa, but I do now understand why it's called Max and they pulled the HBO label off, because you've got Bleacher Report stuff on there. You've got CNN stuff on there. You've got TCM on there. So they're putting all the Discovery, Warner Discovery brands into this one streaming service. So I get why they stripped the HBO name off of it, but it's still Max sounds kind of silly.
So Kartik, on a scale of 0 to 10, with 10 being, you mean, the best ever and 0 being the worst ever, how much equity do you give in the Bleacher Report name?
One.
I'd give it a two out of 10. Like, so to me, I mean, like, so you mean, I'm sure within Max and within Warner Brothers and within Discovery that they kind of think, okay, Bleacher Report, major name, there is that name recognition, at least we know what it is, right? But I think maybe because we're soccer fans and we've gone through all of the all of the bumps and bruises and the really negative experiences with it, and really too, as far as Bleacher Report recently, we don't hear much about any original reporting, any they're not breaking news stories. They rarely come up in, hardly ever hear them mentioned anymore. I'm sure they still get a ton of traffic. I'm sure a lot of it's on mobile apps, etc. But they've really gone off the radar.
For a while, CNN was pushing the idea that their sports that their sports segments were presented by Bleacher Report, which was this, you know, cross promotion nonsense. I don't know if they do that anymore, actually.
All right, listeners. So there's a bunch of different ways you can get in touch with us. We'd love to get your feedback, any comments you have, any questions, any things you'd like to disagree with us about, etc. Let us know. You can call us and leave a voicemail. And that number is 561-247-4625. If you want to go ahead and send us an email, the email address is web@worldsoccertalk.com. You can go ahead and reach us on Twitter, X, and that is @WorldSoccerTalk. Facebook is facebook.com/WorldSoccerTalk. YouTube.com/WorldSoccerTalk. You can post comments there. And last but not least, of course, our website, WorldSoccerTalk.com. Click on the podcast navigation and then go ahead and leave your comments in the most recent episode. And we'll do our best to read out all of the best comments on our next episode. Kartik, what's going on with Beyond the 90? What can listeners and viewers expect to see there, perhaps from this past week or this coming week in terms of coverage?
Yeah, a lot of coverage of the Jacksonville Armada's move to MLS Next Pro, as well as Jacksonville's USL team that's launching your neck of the woods, Jacksonville area. And general conversation about the soccer wars, where the MLS Next Pro season just ended, USL League One season just ended, NISA's in their playoffs, USL Championship, the final is this coming weekend on ESPN2, Charleston and Phoenix. So a lot of positioning going on. This is what happens when you have a federation that's not that's kind of asleep at the wheel in terms of managing pro leagues. And then, of course, a conversation about MIAs, which in the comments section took a completely different turn than I expected. But if, in fact, MIAs, I think this is a conversation we'll probably hopefully have next week on the podcast. If it's confirmed that she's taking the USWNT job, a lot of excitement out there, but it's not confirmed yet. My question mark was, why would the best manager in the world, in my opinion, on the men's or women's side, take the US job? It speaks highly of the US Soccer Federation if they are able to get her, but I have my concerns about how she'll be viewed and whether this is the ideal job for her. So check that out at Beyond the 90.
So quick question, Kartik. Who's better? Who is more qualified? Emma Hayes or Serena Wiegman?
Emma Hayes. No. Emma Hayes is the best manager.
Come on.
Men's or women's. Absolutely. No, absolutely.
Yeah, but what is
Emma Hayes? Granted, this is an international job, and I realize there's a skill set associated with being an international manager, which would be partly my defenses of Greg Berhalter, quite frankly, because, you know, when you start mentioning club managers, I don't know that they fit a national team well. That's a good point. This is an international job, and I hadn't thought about it that way. I think she's the best manager in the world. But again, I'm very club-centric, so maybe there's a case to be made, actually. Yeah, maybe we'll discuss that next week. Maybe I'll write about that this week.
Yeah, maybe I'll be at Beyond the 90. So where can they find a bit Beyond the 90 again? It's on Substack?
Yeah, beyondthe90.substack.com.
All right. And for me and the rest of the gang at World Soccer Talk, you can find us, of course, at worldsoccertalk.com. We've got coverage this week. I'm sure with the Champions League, TV schedules, etc. We're celebrating, actually, this month is our 18th year in existence. And next week, Kartik is going to be hosting a discussion at SoccerX in Miami. In that event, it will be Don Garber, Alexi Lalas. Who else is there? I think Paul Barber from Brighton and Hove Albion. And Kartik, so what's the segment that you're going to be hosting?
Yeah, Malagway is updating his book. I read the 2013 edition. Now I feel like I'm ignorant because apparently he's updated his Messi book, which I wasn't aware of, with information from his move to PSG and his move to MLS. Now, I was not aware of it because it's not out in the U.S. The book is out in Europe, updated edition. So I have his 2013 book. I've read it cover to cover. It is brilliant, as was his book. So I've read three books by him. One was Season on the Brink, I think it was called, about Liverpool, something like that. Outstanding, and really talked about how Rafa Benitez went from being under fire to going to Istanbul and winning Champions League in a famous match. And then his biography of Pep, which gave me a real understanding of Pep. And actually, I should say this, as a Manchester City fan, it's a pleasure to interview him, because my all of my concerns about the appointment of Manuel Pellegrini, I was really unhappy when City sacked Roberto Mancini. Maybe it's my preference for Italian managers, Italian football, that sort of thing. Was not happy about the Pellegrini appointment. When Balogun gave his analysis of Pellegrini's time in Spain at Villarreal, and at, this is before Malaga, so Real Madrid, I was convinced by his analysis, like, okay, this is the right guy. And he turned out to be the right guy. And he was the perfect transition between Mancini and Pep. So I hold his analysis and his writing in high esteem. And it's a great privilege to be able to host a discussion with him at SoccerX. This will be on Tuesday, the 14th. Let me get the date right. So if you're coming to Miami for SoccerX, which a lot of people are, and I know there are different tiers of ticketing. There's some people have already complained to me, oh, they're in a lower tier, they can't go to all the breakout sessions, all the discussions, all the panels. But if you've got the right ticket, check us out 1 o'clock on Tuesday the 14th during the 3 days of SoccerX in Miami.
Yeah, that's going to be awesome. So Kartik hosting and moderating and interviewing Guillaume Balogun, November 14th from 1 to 2 p.m. at Miami SoccerX. What are you going to do this week, and what should the listeners do?
Enjoy your football.